however. Two men could hardly have been more dissimilar than the intense, idealistic, informal young producer and the paunchy, mustache-tugging executive so pompous that even mild Bob Wagner cursed when he mentioned his name. "Look at that title," Pap says. "Executive officer. The whole thing was a military operation." Constable, for his part, had found Pap suspiciously liberal. He was unable to rid himself of the sneaking suspicion, based largely on the fact that Pap was Jewish, that the young producer was making money out of the festival somehow. During Moses' vacation, the friction between their personalities produced sparks, and someone finally brought to Constable's attention a fact of which the Moses organization had not previously been aware, that the year before, testifying before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, Pap, while denying that he was presently a communist, had refused to say whether he had ever been one, and had refused to identify friends who had. He had been fired by CBS TV for this stand, winning reinstatement only after a fight by the Radio and Television Directors Guild. To as passionate a Red hater as Stuart Constable, this revelation was enough to confirm all his suspicions, and he was sure it would have the same effect on RM. So sure was he, in fact, that, without checking with his absent boss, he took a step designed to drive Pap out of the park. In March, just 3 months before the festival was to begin, he informed the producer that the park department could not afford the extra maintenance expense caused by the Shakespeare Festival, that the festival would have to reimburse the department for that expense, and that, since the festival had no funds with which it could guarantee reimbursement, it would be allowed to put on plays only if it charged admission. There would, Mustache said, be no more free Shakespeare in any city park. None of the political commandments ingrained in Robert Moses by his Gamaliel had been ingrained more deeply than the rule stating that an executive gives subordinates absolute loyalty and support, and Moses' belief in this particular commandment was reinforced by the iron bands of his personality. He had, to a remarkable degree, consciously made his muchachos extensions of himself. Admitting to outsiders that one of them was wrong would be almost like admitting that he himself was wrong. Moreover, Moses' loyalty to the Moses men, his refusal, no matter how harshly he might abuse them in private or in front of other members of his clique, to let anyone else criticize them at all, had become within the circles in which he moved an integral part of the Moses legend. Wagner aide Warren Moscow was to verbalize what everyone in city and state government believed. Every Moses deputy could count on the absolute support of his boss if his position was ever challenged by any outsider. That legend was terribly important to Moses. He could not bear to have it defaced. He was its prisoner. Just 3 months earlier, in the 70th birthday interviews of which he had taken advantage to refurbish it, he had made a point of saying that his men, "No, I'll always stand up and take the public beating for them." He could not now publicly overrule one of them. On Moses' return from Barbados, Pap attempted to contact him to persuade him to overrule Constable. He would not come to the phone. Then Pap wrote him, asking about the $50,000 he had promised to raise, money which would, Pap believed, enable him to reimburse the park department and make the season possible even under Constable's conditions. "I didn't hear from him, and I didn't know about the money, and I began pressing," Pap recalls. "And finally I got a letter from him, very terse, very cavalier, no money, and we were planning a whole damn season on his word." A Pap letter pleading for a personal interview drew only a reply setting out for the record the reasons for the park department ruling, that fencing was necessary for control of crowds, that adequate sanitary and dressing facilities for the actors were needed, and, most important, that the lawn on which the audience had sat must be paved over and seats provided because "we can't maintain grass, and serious erosion problems would soon face us unless the area is paved." $50,000 wouldn't begin to meet the cost, Moses wrote. $100,000 to $150,000 would be needed. Certain that he could reason with Moses if he could only talk to him, Papp wrote again pleading for a face-to-face meeting. He had just read a Moses article on Irish playwright Sean O'Casey, Papp said, and, "I feel certain that a genuine rapport can be established because I know that a man who can write with such depth of feeling about O'Casey will certainly understand the dilemma of our organization. I appeal to you to make it possible for this meeting to materialize." Moses replied that, "This matter is entirely in the hands of Stuart Constable." Constable had mentioned an admission charge of $1. Papp said he would consider that price scale. Constable immediately replied that he had changed his mind. $2 would be necessary. Only then did Papp grasp the fact that the real issue was not price, but political philosophy. Constable was determined that no plays produced by a Red like Joe Papp would be allowed in the parks, and that there was no hope of intervention from Constable's boss. If Constable's bloodhounds had been thorough, they would have told him that he was dealing with a fighter, one not ashamed of his past and not afraid to go to the public with a cause. Winning reinstatement at CBS hadn't been easy, after all. Papp had in fact been the first television figure fired as a result of the Un-American Activities Committee hearings ever to do so. Mustache was, moreover, dealing, as would become apparent in later years, with an opponent who knew exactly how to go to the public, with a public relations genius of the first magnitude, of Moses' magnitude, in fact. Closing down his Shakespeare Festival for a full year would mean that the foundations which had been supporting it would lose the habit, and that the company of actors and production personnel he had so painfully brought and held together would fall apart. Even the meager momentum so torturously built up in 4 years of effort would be lost. The New York Shakespeare Festival that was his dream might have to close forever. With his back against the wall, the young producer did what a young state park official with his dream menaced and his back against the wall had done 35 years before. He went to the press, and Joseph Papp went as Robert Moses had gone, not with a defense, but with an attack. "Erosion," he told reporters. "Do people sitting and watching a play create more of an erosion problem than football, softball, soccer, and similar sports encouraged in the parks at no cost to the players?" "Perhaps," he said, "the park situation would be improved by more soil erosion caused by the gathering of 2,000 people each night in an area where 3 years ago only squirrels dared to congregate." Papp spiced his attack and emphasized what it was that Moses was depriving the city of with a device that couldn't miss. Quotes from the Bard. He won the heart of one reporter who asked why he had decided to fight Moses' ban instead of giving in, by asking her in return whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and, by opposing, end them. Moses himself smiled when he read that. "He had never met him, but you could tell he was getting to like the guy," Shapiro says. But he stood up for Constable, although there was a decidedly unwanted gentleness in the press release in which he replied, "I have considerable respect for Mr. Papp's singleness of purpose, but can't adopt it as a principle, and shall certainly not direct Mr. Constable to do so. While the present park administration is in charge, Mr. Papp will have to put his enterprise on a workable basis or go elsewhere. I believe I have the mayor's confidence. Mr. Constable has mine." And when the young producer replied to this by attacking again, "To abandon our policy of free admissions would result in disenfranchising the very people we are anxious to serve," he obtained the results the young Moses had once obtained: unanimously favorable reviews. The Herald Tribune calling Moses short-sighted. The World Telegram saying he was being not merely inconsistent, but capriciously unreasonable. That did it. Moses may have been pulled into the fight reluctantly, but he knew he was in one now, and he fought with his customary enthusiasm and methods. There was behind-the-scenes pressure put on officials whose support Moses needed by the men who he knew could put it on best. Former Police Commissioner George V. McLaughlin was in a position to put it on Police Commissioner Stephen P. Kennedy. McLaughlin to Kennedy, "I am taking the liberty of suggesting that you cooperate." There was the behind-the-scenes innuendo of the type that Jack Madigan believed had worked so well with Mrs. Sulzberger in the matter of Inwood Hill Park. Moses to Corporation Counsel Charles Tenney, "The place is dark and impossible to police adequately. How many couples on the grass came for Shakespeare, and how many for other purposes, I don't know." And there was behind-the-scenes innuendo of the type that had worked so well on opponents during the 1940s. Constable had never revealed the real reason for his hostility toward Papp, but Moses did. On April 23, 1959, a personal message from the park commissioner was delivered to Wagner and other key city officials by a tri-borough messenger who had been instructed to place it in no one's hands but theirs. "As a result of recent experiences, we have looked him up more carefully. He turns out to be a typical of the breed. He took the Fifth Amendment 12 times in June 1958 before the House Un-American Activities Committee." And when behind-the-scenes innuendo did not achieve the desired result, several borough presidents were hinting at support for Papp, Moses moved it onto center stage. It wasn't really erosion he was concerned about, he told reporters. It was muggers, degenerates, and pickpockets, preying on the audience. This was a disorderly type of performance, impossible to police properly, he said. In his mail one morning, he had found a 3-page letter attacking Papp's communist background and questioning his probity in accounting for the donations he collected. The letter contained no proof of these charges, and after Moses was through with it, it contained no signature either. He cut the signature off, turning it into an anonymous communication. Then he had copies made and mailed them to anyone, editors, officials, politicians, he thought might be interested, along with either a covering note stating ominously, "What he, the anonymous writer, says is true, and there is a lot more to it," or a longer letter, such as another one to Corporation Counsel Tenney, stating, "Papp adopts the old left-wing technique of the agitator among artistic and so-called liberal groups, the big lie, etc. He was a communist of long standing, affiliated with all the radicals, took the Fifth Amendment again and again, etc." But it wasn't the 1940s anymore. It was not even the early 1950s. The Senate hearings that had put an end to the McCarthy era had occurred in 1954. The tactics that had driven Stanley Isaacs out of his borough presidency and Rex Tugwell out of New York City backfired when the press learned about them now, especially after Constable, asked by Bill Haddad if the letter did not smack of McCarthyism, replied, "What's wrong with McCarthy?" The letter produced the desired effect in the Daily Mirror and Daily News. "Back Big Bob, Mr. Mayor. Papp has used the smear tactics you'd expect from one who took the Fifth Amendment." But nowhere else. The Post's anger, "The letter was the kind of reckless assault no man with any claim to decency would utilize," was echoed even by Newsday. "Perhaps Jove has nodded." A Post editorial writer also contributed the following ditty, which ran as an editorial. "My name is Robert Moses. I'm Commissioner of Parks. On the subject of Free Shakespeare, I have a few remarks. If the people of this city want this theater on my grass, they'll have to pay $2 a head to get a Moses pass. Now, it is clearly logical that those who disagree are probably subversive, or at least a threat to me. That's why I took it on myself to McCarthyize Joe Papp. Who questions my sagacity gets purged right off the map." And Papp kept attacking, eloquently. "Dear Commissioner Moses, perhaps in politics you have learned that by standing the truth on its head, you can get enough people to believe a lie. You were responsible for circulating a letter questioning my political background and my probity in handling festival funds. The letter represented your second position for denying the festival the use of Central Park. Your first was soil erosion. In position number 3, you called the operation a disorderly type of performance. May I bring to your attention the remarks of a prominent critic who described the Central Park audiences this way. The long, patient line of people hoping to get into an amphitheater that seats 2,300 is a humbling sight for anyone who believes in the theater. The alert attention of the people who do succeed in getting in chastens anyone familiar with sophisticated audiences. Every civic-minded organization has expressed the opinion that Shakespeare in the Parks has had a civilizing effect rather than a disorderly one. One letter writer said, "Thank you for making the park safe again." To keep Shakespeare out of the park because certain elements might prey on the audience is to say that we discontinue all gatherings of people in the park and leave it as a haven for crime. It is my conviction that the more activity in the park, the less lawlessness. I think everyone is growing tired of the distortions, outright fabrications, and anonymous allegations put out by your office. No new excuse you can conjure up will stop us from pressing for the right to continue the free presentation of Shakespeare in Central Park. In the court that mattered most to Moses, the court of public opinion, the second battle of Central Park, like the first, was a battle he couldn't win. Like the first battle, the second leapt onto the front pages with the initial exchange of salvos and stayed there, getting the full New York media spotlight for weeks. And in that spotlight, Moses was again portrayed as villain. Media oversimplification had made the first fight Moses against mothers. It made this fight Moses against Shakespeare. Free Shakespeare at that. Free festival dies. Moses chases Shakespeare off park grass. The bard versus the commissioner. Those were the headlines. Papp even borrowed a pose from Arnold Newman. During the Tavern on the Green fight, the photographer had posed his son leaning sadly against a symbolic Central Park snow fence. Papp posed leaning sadly against one too. The press was questioning Moses' statements now, and Moses could not endure questioning. When he said the festival had harbored crime, reporters checked and wrote stories like the one that said, "You can't prove it by the police records," which showed that there had, during two summer-long festival seasons, been only two crimes on or near its site. Not only editorial writers, but theater critics attacked him, as did columnists from Hedda Hopper and Leonard Lyons to Eleanor Roosevelt, his ancient and bitter enemy, writing, "I cannot help wishing that his decision might be changed." The erosion really involved in the fight now was the erosion of Moses' most priceless property, his name, the continuation and acceleration of the decay that the Tavern on the Green fight had begun 3 years before. Newspapers were filled with letters like the one that said, "As a child, I could visualize poor Mr. Moses working valiantly with pick and shovel, long after everyone else had gone home to bed, just so that I could have a place to play. Today, we have to be practical and make it pay." During the 1930s and 1940s, school children had attached thousands of signatures to memorials praising Moses. Now, a delegation from Lafayette High School, unable to get in to see Wagner, handed Warren Moscow a petition with 1,500 signatures asking the mayor to overrule the park commissioner. During the 1930s and 1940s, high schools had voted Moses the most admired New Yorker. Now, when Helen Hayes, appearing at a high school as a member of a panel on Commissioner Moses' move to abolish free Shakespeare, said, "Abolish Mr. Moses," the students cheered. There was a telling indication of how much he feared what was happening. During the most severe crises of Robert Moses' career, the period in the Order No. 129 fight when it seemed likely that he would lose, for example, his iron constitution had suddenly betrayed him. Each time he had been hospitalized during his adult life, it had been during such a crisis. Now he was hospitalized again for 11 days, with an illness whose precise nature was carefully concealed, but which was variously described as a bad cold, a respiratory infection, viral pneumonia, pleurisy, and nervous exhaustion. Pictures of him leaving the hospital for further rest in Babylon show a man gaunt, hollow-cheeked, with sunken eyes, and under them, circles so dark they seemed almost bruises. A man who suddenly looked, for the first time, old. Although it would still not reveal completely the true nature of the relative power positions of Robert Moses and Robert Wagner, the spotlight focused on the Second Battle of Central Park by the massed New York media would make that relationship clearer than it had ever been before, for the press, able at last to look critically at Robert Moses, now wanted his decision reversed, and looked to the mayor to do so, as was only natural, since it still conceived of Moses as the mayor's subordinate. Aiding in this development was the strategic decision of Pabst. "I made the mayor responsible, really," the producer would recall, "partly because I think he would have liked to help us. He had been helpful to us before. Primarily because I felt that if only I could push the confrontation between the mayor and Moses, make the mayor take responsibility, he would, because of the public opinion on the issue, have no choice but to overrule Moses." "Moses has had his say," he declared publicly. "The public has had theirs. It's now up to you, Mr. Mayor, to insist that the festival be permitted to operate free in Central Park." Pabst's plea was picked up by the press. "Is Bob Wagner or Bob Moses the mayor of New York?" the Post demanded. Luckily for Wagner, city hospital workers were on strike, and he was able to keep very busy trying to arrange a settlement. "He would rather be in the hospital strike 24 hours a day than this," Warren Moscow would recall. But the strike could not last forever, alas, and eventually the mayor could no longer avoid reporters' queries. Pabst's intuition about Wagner was correct. The mayor liked the idea of free Shakespeare in the park. He thought Moses' stand wholly unreasonable. He knew that the real source of the Moses-Pap feud was Constable, and, detesting Constable, he would have loved to overrule him. Moscow, always antagonistic to Moses, saw in this fight a chance to achieve a break between him and Wagner. But, Moscow came to realize, Wagner was seriously handicapped by his fear of the political power of the Catholic Church. If there was one man in the city sure to be influenced by Moses' innuendos that Pap was a left-winger, it was Francis Cardinal Spellman. And of course, for both political and personal reasons, it was wholly unfeasible for Wagner to fire Moses, and Moses made it clear that if the mayor wanted to let Pap use Central Park, that was what he would have to do. Infuriated that the mayor would dare even contemplate intervening, Moses refused even to accept his telephone calls. Every time the mayor's secretaries called Moses' office, they were told that the park commissioner was in the field and couldn't be reached. Moses' stance subjected the mayor to the largest doses of humiliation he had had to swallow since he had been caught between the press and Moses on Manhattan Town 3 years before. Not understanding that the mayor couldn't fire his park commissioner, the press made it seem that he was afraid to. After the first day on which he had to confess that he had been unable to reach his appointee, Wagner promised reporters he would reach him the next day. When he was unable to, the Post addressed some advice to him. How to find the park commissioner? When he was still unable to the next day, the headlines began to read, "Mayor still seeks to reach Moses." Even the Times found the spectacle worthy of a front-page story that began, "Mayor Wagner continued to search for Park Commissioner Robert Moses yesterday. At the end of the day, the mayor's quest was still unrewarded." At a press conference the following morning, Wagner appeared irritated when asked if he had got in touch with Mr. Moses. "I have many more important things to worry about," he said, adding, on a note of impatience, "I'll get in touch with Mr. Moses." He didn't, however, and the heat was taken off only by Moses' hospitalization, which for 11 days made the mayor's dilemma less obvious. Leaving the hospital, however, Moses was asked if he intended to confer with Wagner about Pap. His reply consisted of one word, "No." It was not until more than a week later that Wagner was able to announce that Moses had agreed to meet him for lunch and to promise, in response to reporters' questioning, that he would certainly bring up the anonymous letter. At the lunch, held at a neutral site, ironically the Players Club, founded by the great Shakespearean actor Edwin Booth, the two men dined alone. Moscow was told to wait outside in the mayor's limousine, and the precise details of the conversation are unknown. But, says Moscow, when he came back to the limousine, it was perfectly obvious that he had never had a chance to open his mouth. The mayor would himself later admit that the anonymous letter had never been mentioned. Riding back in the car with him, I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, you're not going to fire him, are you?" He said, "No, I'm not." I said, "Then you have to support him." He said, "You say that?" I said he had no choice if he wasn't to look very weak indeed. So I drafted the statement. Released as fast as the mayor could have it mimeographed, it said, "Although I can't approve of all the ways this has been handled, the only alternative would be to get a new park commissioner. I wouldn't consider that for a moment. He's too valuable a public servant." The mayor had surrendered, and that was the way the press played the story. "Mayor gives in to Moses' ultimatum," was the Herald Tribune headline. And the press did not minimize the loss to the city. Said the news, "Bill Shakespeare loses out as Wagner supports Moses." The Shakespeare Festival was eventually to be saved, and, as Moscow puts it, "we, the Wagner administration, were rescued only by the courts and by certain of Moses' actions puzzling to those who believed he really wanted the festival killed." Turning from City Hall to the courthouse, Papp was rebuffed by a lower court, which reaffirmed the unconditionality of the park commissioner's power over parks, but the appellate division said he could not exercise it in arbitrary and capricious fashion, and ruled he had done so in the Papp case. The court declined to order Moses to issue a permit to the festival, but, in a somewhat ambiguous decision, said he must set reasonable conditions under which the festival could reimburse the city for any expenses. The appellate ruling was a long way short of signaling defeat for Moses, of course. He could have appealed, and precedent suggests he would have won an appeal. Every time similar cases had climbed the judicial ladder past Supreme and appellate courts to the Court of Appeals rung, where the clamor of popular opinion grew faint, that tribunal had ruled that the law, his law, was clear. His power in parks was absolute. Even had his appeal been denied, moreover, its filing alone would have ensured that there would be no festival in 1959 at least. It was, in fact, within Moses' power to kill the festival for the year even without an appeal. The appellate division had left the definition of reasonable conditions up to him. It would have been simple for him to justify conditions, a cash bond to guarantee reimbursement of the $100,000 to $150,000 he had estimated the festival cost the city, for example, impossible for a shoestring producer to meet. Instead, Moses said he would, of course, abide by the court's decision, and said $20,000 would enable the performances to go on under makeshift arrangements, which, it turned out, would be almost precisely the same arrangements as had prevailed in the past. He himself asked the Board of Estimate to provide the funds so that Papp wouldn't have to raise them. The board members, caught between Shakespeare and Spellman, tried to placate both sides, assailing Papp. "I want it clearly understood that in my vote for this item there is no approval of a creature named Papp," Jimmy Lyon said. "I hope that in the future Mr. Moses will find someone whose Americanism is unquestioned." But voting in the money, which, as it turned out, wasn't needed after all. Two philanthropists had previously offered Wagner donations of $10,000 apiece, and the mayor announced that this money would be used instead. Although rehearsals began immediately, there was time remaining for only one production instead of three. But that production, Julius Caesar, was hailed as a triumph, with theater critics taking care to remind their readers whom it was a triumph over. With several broad avenues of legal action still wide open before Moses, this man, who never overlooked even the narrowest legal byway, declined to pursue them and consigned himself to the humiliation of defeat. One explanation is that Moses realized that his previous position was disastrous for his public image and wanted the fight ended as soon as possible, at any cost. Another, advanced by Moscow, always quick to see the basest motives behind Moses' every action, is that Moses believed the $20,000 figure was high enough to kill the festival. According to this theory, Moses thought that Papp couldn't raise the money himself and believed that the Board of Estimate, afraid of Catholic reaction, wouldn't give it to him. Not only the smallness of the figure Moses set, but subsequent events do not support these theories, however. For Moses, who never forgave and never helped someone he considered his enemy, did not act that way with Joseph Papp. Needing trucks, lights, and other heavy equipment for his production, and unable to afford to buy or rent it, Papp asked the park department for it. Constable would have refused the request, but felt he'd better ask RM about it. "Oh, give it to him," was the order. Moses would not see Papp in person. 15 years later, he would still never have met him. But after the season closed, Papp got a letter from him. The young producer had always wanted a theater for his production. The letter said that the park department was going to build one for him. Raising the money for that theater took 3 years. It might never have gotten built at all if publisher George Delacorte had not contributed $150,000 of the necessary $400,000, and Papp was never consulted to the extent he wished on design. But for Moses to allow someone outside his organization a say in design was too much to expect. The crucial point was that Robert Moses built a showcase for the talents of the young man whom he had publicly been fighting so viciously. Papp would not agree with this interpretation. Warren Moscow, who saw the fight from Wagner's angle, would not agree. But Sid Shapiro, the aide closest to Robert Moses, found it difficult to avoid the sneaking suspicion that the fight, into which, Shapiro knew, Moses had been dragged only by the hysteria of a subordinate, was one fight that RM was not at all sorry to lose. There were times, in fact, when Shapiro found himself wondering if RM had not wanted to lose it. Whatever the reason it ended the way it did, his fight with Robert Moses was one of the best things that ever happened to Joe Papp. By making him the hero of the city's wealthy liberals, it gave him the money, both from private contributions and, after the Fifth Amendment flurry had faded from public consciousness, from a Wagner-prodded city government, to make free plays a major element of the city's cultural life. By 1965, when Wagner left office, the city was giving Papp $420,000 a year, to add to $1,900,000 he had received since the Moses fight from private sources, and Papp's troops were playing the Bard not only in the Delacorte Amphitheater, but in the schools, and, from ingenious theaters on wheels, in streets and parks all over New York. Papp was to become so big that when, in 1972, Newsweek did a cover story on him, his fight with Moses 13 years before was worth no more than a few lines. But that fight had been the turning point in Papp's career. "It was the greatest publicity the festival could have had," he himself says. The park commissioner, whom Joe Papp never met, who was identified in the public mind as his enemy, was also his greatest benefactor. But the Second Battle of Central Park was not one of the best things that ever happened to Robert Moses. Occurring at a time when Moses' reputation was trembling in the balance, it helped tip that balance against him, not only by again demonstrating his contempt for the public, but by demonstrating, even more clearly than the First Battle of Central Park, his dominance over the mayor, who was supposedly his superior, his exemption from the normal democratic processes. Stanley Isaacs had been asked on television, "Do you feel that the mayor allows Moses to have his own way?" "Does anyone doubt it?" the elderly councilman had replied. The public had never understood before which one of the two men was really boss. But after the daily barrage of headlines dramatizing the mayor's inability even to persuade his park commissioner to return a telephone call, the public understood now. Moreover, the fight over Shakespeare in the park made Moses a villain not only to the public but to the press. Constable's arrogance toward reporters, an arrogance they assumed had been ordered by Constable's boss, and in particular his ousting them bodily one day from the arsenal, a public building, had infuriated not only the reporters involved, but their editors, and it had given their publishers a new insight into the man who was so charming to them at dinner parties. Before the Pap fight, press scrutiny of Robert Moses had been the work of Hortense Gable's Chipmunks, a handful of young, mostly unknown reporters. There had still been many editors and reporters unwilling to face the falseness of the image they had helped create. There had still been newspapers, most notably, of course, the Times, that had shrunk back from the investigations into Title I. Those newspapers concerned with circulation and the headlines that could boost it understood better now that probing Moses' operations would yield headlines. Those newspapers concerned with their responsibility in a free society understood better now that Moses' operations not only could, but should, must, be scrutinized. It was during the Pap fight that the Times decided to do its own investigation of Title I, assigning hard-working Wayne Phillips to the task. The fight documented to the newspaper establishment what rebel reporters like Gleason and Cook and Haddad and Kahn had been trying to explain for years. The media's new awareness was particularly significant because it is so strongly influenced by the images that are its own creation. For years, articles about Robert Moses had been researched, written, and played in the light of the image of Robert Moses as hero. Now, Robert Moses was a villain. If the press was to obtain information of the kind it had previously downplayed, now it would upplay it, mercilessly. And a vast new store of that information quickly became available. Chapter 45. Off to the Fair. In May 1959, New York's Citizens Union, the most prestigious organization of the civic reformers from whose ranks Robert Moses had sprung, but who had long since disowned him, sent his slum clearance committee a list of questions about Title I sponsors. And the press not only demanded answers, but when Moses supplied them, played them as no Moses statement had ever been played. The tone of Moses' reply to the union was one of indignation that such questions should be asked of him, and of assurance that his answers would lay all doubts to rest. But that was not the way it worked out. To a question asking who had proposed the Manhattan Town and Pratt developments, for example, Moses replied by naming Congressman Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jr., and various civic organizations. In previous years, the press would have printed that statement at face value. Now, several papers pointed out that, as the Post put it, the reply makes no mention of the fact that Samuel Caspert, a Tammany politician, was the prime mover in both sponsoring groups. Moses' admission that the sponsors had been selected without competitive bidding, and that Caspert and company had been given Pratt despite years of failure to produce at Manhattan Town, was emphasized, not buried. Such admissions sounded sinister enough, but it was questions 5 and 6, or rather Moses' answers to those questions, that were to prove most damaging. Question 5 was, were written reports made to the mayor's slum clearance committee, reviewing the qualifications of the various bidders? Question 6 was, if written reports were made, are they in the files of the slum clearance committee, and may they be inspected by responsible persons or groups, in particular the press? Of course written reports were made, Moses replied indignantly. Of course they were in the committee's files, and of course they may be inspected by responsible groups or persons. The Post's Haddad and Kahn and the Telly's Gleason promptly said they wanted to inspect them. They could hardly believe it. They were going at last to get a look at Robert Moses' files, the files no outsider had ever looked at before. It was a great day, the day he said we could look at those files, I'll tell you that, Haddad says. A great day. About the reasons for Moses' reply, one of his greatest tactical blunders, it is possible only to speculate. He may simply have felt he had no choice. A mayoral-appointed committee was no public authority whose records could be concealed behind the excuse that they were records of a private corporation. They were clearly public records, open to the public by law. The people demanding them were, moreover, people who would hold him to that law. The reformers had never hesitated to take him to court, and against their money and free legal talent, his customary stalling and expense-incurring legal maneuvers would not work. Eventually, no matter how many appeals were instituted, there would be a final legal decision that the records must be opened. If he fought, he would lose. Losing, and losing to the men he hated above all others, would, for this man who hated to lose, be bad enough. And refusal to open his books would make it seem as if he had something to hide. For this man to whom his public image was so dear, such a stance would be intolerable. He may simply not have known what was in those files. His preoccupation for almost 5 years with the massive power dams at Messina and Niagara had forced him to delegate authority for Title I far more than for any other enterprise. Perhaps he was simply unaware of the extent to which Shanahan, Spargo, and Liebwahl had made political pull or financial tie the main qualification for Title I sponsorships. And even if he did know, and he must have been aware of at least some of his aide's manipulations, he must have had some idea of what was in those files, he appears not to have fully realized how those manipulations would look to the public. Insulated from the public for decades, insulated moreover by a coterie to whom such manipulations were standard procedure, he appears not to have understood how deeply revelation of Title I's secret scorecard would shock the other, larger world outside. Had he time to think about the situation, this realization might have come to him, but he had less time to think than ever. With barely 6 weeks before the opening of the Great Messina Dam, which Queen Elizabeth II and Vice President Richard M. Nixon were scheduled to attend, the dam was far from completed. The contractors had to be driven, and 1,000 last-minute details had to be overseen, and, with the pages of that huge calendar on the wall over his head falling inexorably one by one, Moses was working 14, 16, 18 hours a day. Bill Chapin was to remember the last months before the Messina opening, with the telephone awakening him and his boss's voice rasping over it sometimes at midnight and sometimes at 5 a.m. and sometimes during the hours between, as months of unmitigated exhaustion, and Bill Chapin was 55. Robert Moses was 70. Incredibly, he showed not a sign of fatigue. He seemed as tireless at 70 as he had been at 30. But there was little time to spare for administration of the city park system, where the PAP episode was a time-consuming irritant, for the 11 major state park expansion projects he was undertaking on Long Island, the 4 major expressways he was ramming through the city, the 2 great suspension bridges, one underway, the other in the final stages of planning, and certainly not for consideration of the best way to handle the impudent Citizens Union request. He may simply have felt that he could conceal most of the scorecard. Whether with or without his knowledge, the files would, when reporters got to see them, be stripped virtually clean of revealing material. He may have believed that it was possible for his aides to remove all of it. Moreover, reporters had investigated his operations before. In almost every case, his reputation had ensured that editors had not given the reporters the time necessary to investigate in the necessary depth. In the rare cases in which reporters, such as Milton Mercuson, had nonetheless uncovered some of his secrets, his influence with publishers had been sufficient to get the stories killed or toned down. He may have heard so much about investigations that he no longer worried about them. And, as would later become apparent, he had not realized the crucial change that had occurred. the tarnishing of his reputation to a point at which reporters would now be given the time to make their investigations thorough, and at which the facts they uncovered would now be examined and played by the same standards as facts revealed about other public officials, standards which placed a premium on sensationalism. For years, every fact he had fed the press had been grist for a mill whose end product was something sweet to him. He appears not to have realized, until he saw the play of his replies to the Citizens' Union, that now any facts the press uncovered were going to be grist for a mill that could grind out only bitterness. And that realization came too late. He had already put himself on record publicly. He tried to draw back, stalling for 2 weeks while Triborough Council Liebwohl told the reporters who telephoned every day that the records were still being assembled. But with editorials reminding the public of his promise to make them available, he could not stall indefinitely. On May 29, 1959, Haddad and Kahn, Gleason apparently did not call that day, telephoning Liebwohl, were suddenly told to come ahead.
"Christ, we were just dying to get to see that stuff," Haddad recalls, "and of course there was nothing there."
After he and Kahn had arrived at the Triborough Authority's Randall's Island headquarters, Liebwohl kept them waiting for hours before sending a secretary to escort them into a small, narrow room, walls painted institutional green, in the middle of which was a narrow conference table on which had been piled stacks of file folders. The moment when the two reporters flipped open the first one was historic. Robert Moses had been in public office for 35 years, and this was the first time that any reporter had gotten a look at his files. Historic, but not significant. The folders were bulging with papers, but these papers turned out to be building plans, brochures, formal memoranda written for the record. In Haddad's words, all pro forma stuff. They could find no information of significance, particularly not about the individuals in whom they were most interested, the sponsors. The next day, after being kept waiting for hours again, the two reporters asked Liebwohl where this information was, and were referred to Spargo. Haddad recalls their meeting with Triborough's general manager vividly. "That little shit sitting in that big office eating a bowl of soup, while feeding them only evasive answers. What qualified a sponsor to become a sponsor? That was all we were asking," Kahn recalls. "We didn't even suspect that a sponsor might be someone who had never built something and had no money or financial backing to build anything." But they could get no answers to their questions, and the files yielded none and seemed likely to yield none. "They had stripped them completely," Haddad recalls. "But for some reason," Kahn says, "we kept looking. It was just like police work. You write down every name you come across, and that night, when you get back to the office, you check it in the clips, just in case you'll find something." "We were tilting at windmills," Haddad says, and the accuracy of the image seems demonstrated by their mount. The giants they were trying to pull down from their castles, Moses, Shanahan, Rosenman, Goldwater, had big black Cadillacs. So did Haddad, a Cadillac he had bought for $22. "It was ancient," the young reporter would recall. "The windows rolled up and down, sometimes. Generally, they remained firmly in whichever position they happened to be. The post-copy girls, whom Haddad squired, became accustomed to getting very wet in the rain. The window problem was, however, insignificant compared to the overheating problem." Recalling the Title I investigation years later, Joe Kahn recalls more vividly than the stories he wrote the difficulty in keeping the engine cool while researching them. The trip back downtown to the post office from Randall's Island was too far for the vehicle, which just managed to make it to 64th Street, where there was a gas station at which they could obtain enough water to keep the engine cool as far as the downtown athletic club, whose friendly doorman would run inside for water whenever he saw them coming. The overheating problem was complicated by the hood problem, which resembled the window problem. It frequently wouldn't go up. Once, carried away by enthusiasm, they tried to make it all the way back to their office without stopping for water.
The car boiled over in the Battery Park underpass, and the hood stuck fast. Passing motorists gaped as the two reporters tried to cool off the car by throwing pails of water on the closed hood. Every morning they would pull up to Triborough headquarters in that sputtering car, apprehensive. It looked like a military fortress, and they had guards all around. And a light, looking in their shabby sports jackets like the $140-a-week reporters they were. In deference to their surroundings, Haddad wore a tie, but this attempt at respectability was somewhat undermined by his inability to button his collars. He had bought the wrong size shirts. And walk inside, to sit waiting for hours for Liebwohl's pleasure, and then be shown into the narrow little room by a flunky who made no attempt to conceal his contempt, to begin hours of plowing through meaningless documents, hoping that somewhere in those files they would find information enabling them to prove that the Moses image was a false image. And then one day, they found it. It was in one of the file folders relating to a Title I project which had received almost no publicity at all, one called Mid-Harlem. In that folder, apparently overlooked by whoever had stripped it, was a letter. Just this long, Kahn would recall, holding up his fingers an inch or two apart, from a man applying to be one of the sponsors, together with a note indicating that his application had been approved. The man's name was Louis I. Pulgrass. Haddad seemed to recall hearing that name during his days with the Kefauver Crime Committee, but he couldn't recall in what connection. Back in the office that night, however, they pulled Pulgrass's clip file, and as soon as I saw those clips, I said, "Holy Christ, Joe, look at this!" This was clips on Kefauver Committee hearings, in which it had been disclosed that in his previous business dealings, Louis I. Pulgrass had had as secret partners underworld kingpins Frank Costello, Meyer Lansky, and Joe Adonis. "That was the one that did it," Kahn says. "Pulgrass was the guy that crumbled him. When organized crime got into the picture, that blew the lid off." Frank Costello was a name that, to the average newspaper reader, threw off reverberations as powerful in one context as Robert Moses did in another. And the story in which this Costello associate figured was as simple and dramatic as most previous slum clearance stories had been complicated and obscure. With the first Post headline on June 30, 1959, on the new revelation, "Costello Pal Got Title I Deal," Moses' urban renewal program was scandal in a way in which, despite 3 years of previous exposés, it had never been scandal before. Overlooked by Moses' file strippers among the bland minutes and reassuring brochures in the Mid-Harlem file folders had been another single sheet of paper, not even a full-size sheet of paper, but a handwritten note containing dynamite enough not merely to chip, but to blast a substantial hole in the Moses image. The handwriting on the note was Tom Shanahan's, and what the note said was that he had been made aware of a delicate situation involving Pulgrass, and the date on the note was several weeks before the Slum Clearance Committee had approved Pulgrass's application. Gleason either came across that piece of notepaper himself or was fed it by Haddad, and with the first World Telegram headline the following day, "Banker Had Warning on Costello Pal," the scandal had an added, significant dimension. Not only had Robert Moses' committee approved an associate of racketeers as a slum clearance sponsor, it had done so although Moses' key colleague on the committee had known he was an associate of racketeers. Of all the charges that might have crumbled the image of Robert Moses, none could have been more unfair. He had never met Pulgrass. If he had ever heard his name, he did not recall it. He certainly had no idea that one of his sponsors had had underworld connections. To him, the Mid-Harlem sponsors were Colonel Bennett's group. It was represented by the former judge, state attorney general, Democratic gubernatorial candidate, and, as chairman of the City Planning Commission, his obedient lackey, Colonel John J. Bennett. Moses had left the investigation of the syndicate behind Bennett entirely to Shanahan. Mid-Harlem was one of the projects over which he had delegated the banker complete authority. But Kahn was right. By giving the Title I program underworld overtones, the Pokras story was the one that crumbled him. Not only reporters, but other persons hostile to the coordinator suddenly, for the first time, began trying to find other evidences of underworld infiltration of Title I, and an aide in the controller's office soon found one. In the payroll records filed in the office by the Washington Square Village Corporation, he told Gleason, there appeared, as a temporary night watchman, the name of Vincent the Chin Gigante, a former boxer who had been accused and then acquitted of being the hitman in a contract put out on Costello by other mafia figures. He had, a year before, ambushed the underworld overlord in his apartment house lobby, but had only grazed him with a pistol shot. "Reveal thug held Title I village job," the World Telegram blared. "Could any charge be more grotesque?" Moses demanded. Hardly. The Chin had not been hired by the Title I committee. He had not been hired by the sponsor to whom the committee had awarded the village job. He had not even been hired by the contractor to whom the sponsor had awarded the construction work on the job. Not that the identity of men on the contractor's payroll would have been scrutinized by the sponsor anyway, much less by the committee. He had been hired by one of the contractor's subcontractors. "The inference is that this committee should not have permitted his employment, and, having stood idly by while this atrocity went on, is guilty of association with mysterious gangsters," Moses said. "This committee has no responsibility for the help employed by contractors for sponsors and could not possibly have. And in any event, as a matter of fairness and decency, is Mr. Gigante, who was acquitted of failure to take good aim at Mr. Costello, when out of jail not entitled to find work of some sort to keep him out of further mischief?" Such witty ridicule would have once turned back any charge. The reporter responsible would have been hastily reassigned. Now he was reinforced. A whole platoon of investigative reporters rode out on the slum clearance trail. The trail was marked by anonymous tips and by other scattered pieces of information overlooked in Moses' files, marked clearly enough so that these reporters could see now where it was really leading. Abandoning side trips, like the search for underworld connections, they stuck now on the main road that led them at last to the truly significant secret behind Title I, the secret that would destroy the heart of the Moses legend. Haddad led the pack, for he had the gift of seeing patterns, and he saw them in the seemingly innocuous material, minutes, memos, letters, notes, scattered before him on the narrow table in the little room. One, for example, was woven around press agents. Reading through endless reams of documents, Haddad noticed that two names kept reappearing in files relating to different projects: William J. Donahue and Sidney S. Barron. He didn't know who Donahue was, but Kahn, with his encyclopedic knowledge of city politics, did. A press secretary for both O'Dwyer and Impellitteri, and a key Tammany insider. And everyone knew who Barron was, of course. Carmine DiSapio's personal publicist. Pulling up his tie as far as it would go to conceal his open shirt collar, Haddad walked with Kahn onto the ankle-deep carpets of the silken-draperied, sliding-paneled room, adorned with just one photograph, that of a man with dark-tinted glasses, that was Sidney Barron's office, and wrung from him an admission that he had formed an association of Title I sponsors that paid him $1,500 a month. He swore that he had never received a fee from individual sponsors, but federal audits, leaked to Haddad now by Walter Freed, who had chafed so long at his inability to curb Moses, revealed that he lied. And one sponsor told the reporters, "It would be fantastic to tell you we hired Barron for any other reason than his influence." And Kahn and Haddad made clear where that influence came from, identifying Barron as Tammany's and Carmine DiSapio's press chief. The same story was repeated with Donahue. Gleason, thundering hard at Haddad's heels, had received a tip about a 92-acre tract at Clarsen's Point on Long Island Sound in the Bronx that had been selected for a slum clearance project to be called Soundview, even though it was not a slum at all, but a community of 245 neat, well-tended